Hey folks, Adam Summer here for the Heartland Pod for this Thursday edition of the pod, July 21st. This is another installment of Let's Have a Chat, and it's another one where I get to take a break. All I did was put this one together and record this little intro. If you're new to our show, thanks for joining us. You can catch us 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, the analysis show with myself, Rachel Parker, and Sean Diller on Mondays, chats on Tuesdays and Thursdays, the flyover view on Fridays with Kevin Smith as a recap of the news stories, and on Wednesdays a rotating show between the High Country with Sean Diller, a report from the Mountain West, and the Delta with Nicholas and Christina Linke, who give us a Midwestern couple's view on reality and science and parenting and a whole bunch of good stuff surrounding their world. That's what we do over here. We appreciate you stopping by and checking us out. If you have the time, go ahead and subscribe, scroll on down, give us a 5-star rating, leave us a review while you're listening to the episode. This one is a chat with Rachel Parker, and she is interviewing Pat Garofalo. Pat is coming to us from the American Economic Liberties Project, and he wrote a piece that caught Rachel's eye. So she reached out to Pat to come on the show, and the two of them have a really interesting chat. The American Economic Liberties Project, it really focusing on what corporations and billionaires have done in the United States and the role that they have played, the remarkably outsized role that they have played in shaping not just politics in general, but policy and really your day-to-day life in ways that you might not even imagine. That they've had their hand in the pot, so to speak. So that's what this chat is about with Rachel Parker and Pat Garofalo. Make sure to follow us on Twitter with @TheHeartlandPod. We're on Facebook and Instagram with The Heartland Pod as well. And find us at heartlandpod.com, where you can check out information on all of our shows, all of our information, and subscribe. Let's get to it.
And welcome to a special episode of Let's Have a Chat. My name is Rachel Parker. You'll normally hear me on our flagship Monday show called Talking Politics, where I digest and then regurgitate some of the more Heartland-centric news items from the week with my friend and co-hosts, Sean Diller and Adam Summer. And increasingly, you're going to hear me on the mic doing our weekly episodes of Let's Have a Chat, which we try to blast out a couple times a week. And I hope that you guys are enjoying it. I am always open on Twitter if you guys have suggestions for or ideas about folks that we should talk to. We love meeting new people. We love elevating voices, particularly of people who are doing the work without the recognition or who are doing the work who need to raise some money for a campaign or for an event that's near and dear to your, an event or a cause that's near and dear to your heart. We'd love to hear about that too. So feel free to reach out and find us on Twitter. And this week, I'm really excited about who I get to talk to. So one of the really delightful things about doing the work that we do here on the Heartland Pod is the amount of people that we get to meet who are, as we'd like to say, doing the work. I've known of Pat Garofalo for a little while. He's an author. He's a former journalist. He is the founding editor of Think Progress, but he is no longer there. He now is at the American Economic Liberties Project. And his focus of interest there as a stakeholder is something that's going to be near and dear to a lot of the folks who listen to the pod, particularly people that follow politics in and around St. Louis and Kansas City, who are well aware of the kinds of tax benefits that developers get here. And we're talking about a piece that he wrote on his Substack, which is called The Boondoggle, about a recent audit by our very own Nicole Galloway. And again, he and I have exchanged ideas and thoughts on Twitter in a very friendly and healthy way. I know that does happen on Twitter. There are people that exchange ideas in a healthy and friendly way on Twitter. And he wrote at the very top of his most recent Substack post, he said that Nicole Galloway is one of his favorite politicians in the country. And I thought, well, if that's not reason to invite him on the podcast to talk about his most recent article, then I don't know what is. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce my special chat with Pat Garofalo.
Let's have a chat.
So I'm here for a special edition of Let's Have a Chat with someone who I will admit that we kind of Twitter know each other a little bit, but we've never officially met before. So it's just a pleasure to bring Pat Garafolo onto the Heartland Pod this morning. And I'm just going to throw it, Pat, I'm just going to throw it over to you to introduce yourself and talk a little bit about the work you do, where you do it, and how long you've been doing it.
Totally. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. So I'm Pat Garafolo. I'm the director of state and local policy at a shop called the American Economic Liberties Project. We are a research and advocacy org that focuses exclusively on corporate power issues. So anything we can do to reduce corporate power and corporate influence over the economy or democracy, we are into it. And so doing state and local stuff that includes a lot of the sort of economic development-y stuff that I imagine we're going to be talking about quite a bit on this episode. And my background was I'm a recovering journalist. I was an economics journalist at a blog that no longer exists called Think Progress. And then I moved to US News and World Report for 5 years. And while I was there, I wrote a book called The Billionaire Boondoggle, which is all about how states and cities goof up their economic development by being too corporation friendly, by pouring money into corporate tax breaks and hoping that some of it will trickle down to workers and local businesses. And yeah, your area is very familiar with a lot of these challenges. So I'm psyched for the conversation today.
To say the least. Yeah. And you also have, talk a little bit about your Substack, because you have a Substack.
Oh,
also.
Yes, totally. Yeah, that's a really good thing since it's the my main writing activity at the moment. Yeah, I have a Substack called Boondoggle, which started with some of the reporting that I did after my book came out that didn't quite make it in, or follow-ons from stories that I wrote about in there that had developed. And now it's just a running place for me to write about and report on state and local development issues, state and local corporate power issues. And it's been really great, a really great experience. I've been doing it for a little over 2 years now because of the folks like yourself that I find while doing it. You know, we've got a really nice little community. The number of folks that write in with tips or questions about what's going on in their local city council or in their state house or with their planning board, it's really, really nice. It's a really nice way to build a community of people who are interested in what sounds like a niche issue, but I think isn't.
It's so important to
everything that happens around us in our neighborhoods, in our communities.
And it's related to so many things too. So there's a few threads that we follow in the Heartland Pod. And I know, like, you probably maybe vaguely knew we existed because we've chatted before on Twitter. And we started talking on Twitter because you were posting about some tax break legislation or whatever the hell, or policies or whatever, that are heading through Georgia right now. I think it was Georgia. I can't remember exactly where it was. And I was talking to you about my experience living in Los Angeles and how the film industry there, the production community, was gutted when tax breaks incentives in Vancouver drained the, like, basically, like, there's very little production that happens in Los Angeles anymore, which is like what people don't really realize. Like, it's mostly out of state, mostly in Georgia, Vancouver, other places, New Mexico now. Maybe it was New Mexico that was starting to look at tax breaks. I can't remember, to be honest.
Yeah, it was New Mexico and Louisiana.
Right, there we go. Yeah,
pioneered this.
Yep, yep. So we started having a conversation about that, and that's how I kind of learned more about you. And on that note, when you talk about how it's a niche issue, one of the things that we really talk about, we kind of, my podcast producer and partner, Adam Summer, likes to say that we have a middle-out approach. So we talk about how these policies affect the Midwest, and then we kind of talk about them out to kind of the other parts of the country where people are more kind of like associate more with progressive politics. And we talk about school choice a lot on our platform. And school, I feel like school choice and TIFs, local tax incentives, are very closely related because they're sponsored by the same people. The people who have brought you school choice on the state level are very interested in robbing local municipalities of their ability to invest in local schools, because if they divest in local schools, they also divest from teachers' unions. So all these things are so interrelated. And in fact, they're so interrelated that if you follow this issue, you probably know that the Los Angeles City Council has been completely torn asunder by this. If you look at the indictments on the LA City Council side that have been handed down over the past few years, and looked at the indictments that happened, same body, federal regulators came, federal officials came in, cops, the FBI came in, and they were like, we're going to arrest you. And if you put those indictments side by side and like blacked out the parts of town you're talking about, you would not be able to decipher whether or not the indictments were for a Los Angeles city council member or a member of the St. Louis Aldermanic Board, because that's how identical they are. So anyway, so thank you so much for coming on. It's a real pleasure to have you. I would like to talk a little bit about why we're talking today, because you wrote a post about our very own Nicole Galloway and an auditor's report that she released last week. As you can understand, our state has been a little bit distracted lately with, some crazy gun laws and the hot bragging that the state attorney general and governor couldn't wait to do when they were the first state in the country to pass an full abortion ban. So what may have fallen, which is one of the other reasons that I was so excited when you said you'd come and talk about this. So one of the things that understandably fell through the cracks last week was Nicole Galloway's report about this tax holiday that big box stores get that costs the state literally, between 100 and 200 million, $200 million in revenue every year. So I'm just going to say hundreds of millions. It's not quite hundreds, but it's very close to it. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and talk about what brought your attention to her, and if you've been following her as an auditor in the past, and just about the Substack that you wrote.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have been following her for quite a while. As I said in the piece, she's one of my favorite elected officials in the country, which is, it's maybe weird to have an auditor be one of your favorite elected officials, or to have a favorite elected official at all.
I'm gonna approve. I heartily approve this message, yeah.
But she is great, and I think in general has an eye towards issues like this, where the government and policy is either out of intent or often incompetence, preferencing large dominant corporations over smaller local businesses. It's a problem we run into all the time, is one policy or another, be it tax, be it labor, be it local economic development zoning, is rigged in favor of the big guys, is rigged in favor of big box stores and big developers, and makes it that much harder for smaller local businesses to compete. In fact, often those smaller local businesses are forced to subsidize their larger dominant competitors. So in Missouri, yeah, there's this thing called it's the sales tax discount. And you can't see this because it's a podcast, but I'm making air quotes around discount. What essentially happens is that retailers are allowed to keep 2% of the sales tax that they collect from their customers. You know, stores are responsible for collecting sales tax and then sending it into the state. That's your responsibility as a seller. In Missouri, in return for doing this on time, you're allowed to keep 2%. Lots of states have this, a couple dozen, but almost every other one caps it at some percentage or some dollar amount per month or per quarter, whatever they say. Yeah, you can keep 1.5% up to $110 a month, for instance. Missouri has no cap, so sellers are allowed to keep 2% of every single dollar in sales tax that they collect to the end of time. This is the most generous giveaway in the country on the sales tax discount. And Auditor Galloway correctly pointed out that this really, really benefits, the lack of a cap really benefits the corporations that do the most retail. She doesn't name names in the report, but you can kind of guess at who's going to get the most benefit from this, right? Walmart, Best Pro Shop, Target, Amazon,
Home like Depot. The kind of, yeah,
totally, the kind of who's who of large retailers. And the like genesis of this idea, depending on which state you're in, it kind of dates back to about the 80s, was that collecting sales tax was kind of a pain for these stores. And so they should get a little incentive to do it on time. That's not really the case anymore, right? We all have computers. It's like boop, 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 send it in, it's done. Yet this preference still exists. And it's just one of those kind of tiny twiddly things that are lying around that preference large dominant corporations and make it that much harder for smaller retailers to compete. And not only that, as you said, it's costing in excess of $140 million a year. And I can imagine you, as someone who is really steeped in Missouri policy, can think of a lot of things you'd like to do with $140 million that aren't give it to Walmart.
Well, and also, like, or don't take it from me. Like, that's the other, like, pick a lane. Either don't take it from me every time because we tax groceries here. We have some of the highest regressive sales taxes in the country. And it keeps coming up in front of the state legislature, which is, I mean, I've told friends recently, I just had a really long conversation with a very good friend of mine who's not in politics, but has worked for campaigns in his life. And we were talking about the abortion ban, and we were talking about the January 6th hearings. We just had this kind of like long-ranging conversation about kind of where we are as a nation. And I was like, you can't look at states like Missouri and Arkansas and Oklahoma and whatever and think we're democracies anymore, because we're kind of really not. So we have 40 some odd Democratic representatives in the state legislature on the House side, and which of course was where budget things start, right? The budget always starts in the House. And they've tried over and over and over again to rewrite various aspects of our regressive sales tax policy, including like don't charge for groceries, like don't put a sales tax on food. Mm-hmm. So imagine that when you're at Walmart and you're buying food, which you shouldn't be paying sales tax on, the money is going 2% of every dollar that you spend. So 2 cents of every one of your dollars is going directly into Walmart's pocket and Kroger's pocket. I'm pretty sure that the two largest grocery store chains in the country do not need more of my money, right? Like, that's just not necessary. So talk a little bit more, if you will, about some of the other states where these loopholes exist. And if there's any recent examples that you can point to, you point out, I think, a Michigan Supreme Court decision that recently happened. I think that was at the end of your this particular post that you made. And what those state legislatures or the voters or anybody has been able to do to, okay, so if there's a novel $100 or whatever that they get to keep to, you know, that could help a small retailer, though, for example. Like if you're a small retailer and you get a $200 tax break for filing your sales tax return for the quarter, that might help you. Like that could pay for your accountant or something. But what are the states that have successfully rolled back some of these tax holidays, and how recently has that happened?
Yeah, totally. So you used to be, and like Auditor Galloway has been screaming about this for years. You can go back to 2016 and find her saying, hey, like you really need to do something about this, like get it together. Colorado, it was just a couple of years ago, actually used to have the most generous sales tax discount in the country. And you all in Missouri were second, but Colorado put a cap on it. They said, all right, you can, I forget exactly what the figure was, but it was a few hundred dollars a month, to exactly your point, right? That can be very, very useful if you're a small retailer to get a couple extra $100 a month to make your books balance. That I can see that's defensible. I tend to not like tax preferences in, but I get the justification for having some sort of benefit for the smaller folks. But yeah, to kind of endlessly allow a giant national or multinational retailer to collect this stuff as much as they want, as much, you know, as fast as they can sell things, doesn't make a lot of sense. I don't see what you're getting. Most of that money is just not going to stay in the community. It's going to leak out. It's going to go back to corporate headquarters. It's going to go into CEO pay. It's going to wind up in the Cayman Islands. It's going to be like helping folks buy yachts. Like that's just not doing much of anything for the community. And that's sort of endemic to economic development as a whole, not just in Missouri, but across the country. If you look back, there have been kind of phases of economic development across our history, and you can actually go back to even before there was a United States to see the first corporate tax handouts in American history. Actually, the very first one went to Alexander Hamilton for a manufacturing campus in Paterson, New Jersey, that he set the bar. It never actually got built, and a bunch of his associates wound up in jail. And so he really did set
the mold. Exactly. He's like, here it is.
Exactly. This is how this is going to go for the next several hundred years. But the modern era, you can kind of date back to about the 1930s when Southern economies, and most notably Mississippi, started trying to diversify away from agriculture. And their hot idea was to steal Northern manufacturing plants via tax credits and incentives, and so entice them to come to the South. You can actually go back through the congressional record. You can see Senator and future President Kennedy's complaining about these Southern states coming along and poaching all of Massachusetts' manufacturing plants and how unfair it all was. And that sort of started the modern era, and it's really morphed into this giant, almost industry into and of itself. $95 billion a year is spent at the state and local level on company-specific corporate tax incentives. So that's money given to one company in particular to do a particular thing. $95 billion across the country. And that's none of that is federal. That's literally all state and local. And as you noted, a lot of that has got to be coming out of schools because a lot of that is in the form of property tax breaks, which because of our goofy system of school funding is how we've decided to fund schools. So it's kind of direct one-to-one. And we've been sold for the last decades the story of this being a successful model for local economies. You just have to shell out hundreds of million dollars for a giant plant or for an Amazon warehouse or for a Walmart, and prosperity will follow. And just about everyone who's looked at this from the journalism side, from the academic side, has found that that's not the case, but they have such a nice cute little story to tell, it kind of feels right, that it can be really hard to combat this kind of stuff, especially because politicians, and I imagine this is what we'll get into a lot, politicians are really invested in this system, not because it produces any sort of economic return, but because it produces political return. The studies have shown that politicians who engage in more corporate tax dealmaking get more votes in their subsequent elections because of the political capital they accrue. They can send out press releases. They can go on Twitter and be like, I created or saved so many jobs. Look at me doing things. It's sort of the impression of action at the local level to do good things for constituents. And so it can be very hard to tell the kind of wonky story about actually why that's not happening. Sometimes you get nice examples like Foxconn up in Wisconsin, which was a total bust, like Amazon HQ2 being chased out of New York for very good reasons. There was a huge corruption scandal. There's one more for your list. There was a huge corruption scandal in Anaheim recently that revolved around Disney and tax breaks they were getting there. And then Auditor Galloway coming out with this report showing how this stuff goes awry. So like you can sometimes like find little chinks in the armor, but they do have a very good, a compelling story to tell. It can be very hard to push back because of all the political reasons. And actually, I'm going to tell you my favorite stat, and it's because it's horrible. My favorite stat about corporate tax incentives is that one of the best ways to figure out if a state is going to increase its corporate tax dealmaking in any given year is not to look at any economic indicator. Don't look at incomes, don't look at jobs, don't look at anything. Simply see if the incumbent governor is going to be up for re-election. That is one of the most reliable ways to see if a state is going to increase its corporate tax break spending, because the governor wants to be re-elected and knows that that's a path to doing it.
Hey guys, it's Adam. Just a quick break from the interview to remind you that we have our other shows Monday through Friday. Make sure to check them out if you're new to our feed. Just go ahead and hit the subscribe button, and if you could leave us a review, we would love it. A 5-star rating goes a long way to helping other folks find this episode and other shows. And be sure to share it on your social media or just text it to a friend. Text the link really quickly while you're listening. We really appreciate you coming by to check us out here at the Heartland Pod. Check us out at heartlandpod.com and sign up for our Patreon to support what we're doing. Every little bit helps. We have a $2 a month level, and you can do that and make a big difference to help us change the conversation. Now back to the chat.
I wish that I could give ours that much credit. We have such a strange... Missouri's political fates right now are so... I don't know that... this is kind of a once in a century, you've got to be fucking kidding me moment that we're having right now in Missouri. So we won't go into that. That's a whole other separate conversation. But our governor kind of lucked into the job. And speaking of governors, he defeated Nicole Galloway last cycle, like handily. It wasn't even close. And that's
yes,
a podcast.
I was sad.
Yeah, that's a podcast. That's a podcast for another day. So it's interesting that we're having this conversation, because I do feel like all these sort of like, whether it's state tax incentives for big corporations or tax incentives for more localized development, these pigeons kind of have an interesting way of coming home to roost. And I would just kind of maybe say this to you generally and hear your feedback. I think voters are much more aware today than they ever were before about the negative impact on their communities that it has, not just on schools, but also just on the lack of returns that communities get on these massive investments that their city government makes on their behalf without their permission. One great example that I'll point to locally is that the reason the Rams are now the LA Rams and no longer the St. Louis Rams is because St. Louis voters said a handful of years ago, like, we built a stadium for you. I'm sorry, it's not good enough. You're married to Walmart money. Use your own money to build your own stadium. And it resulted in a stadium that is now located in Los Angeles that was built entirely with private funds. I think they did get a pretty good deal on the land. I don't remember the exact full details of it, but it was a very big deal in LA because it was one of the first stadiums to be built in the country in the last 25 years without a dime of public money. So maybe talk a little bit about that, like where you see either successful pushback or how you feel like that on the ground conversation's been changing since you've started really kind of paying attention to and shaping the discussion around this conversation.
100%. Yeah, that's a good example. And yeah, the sports stadium thing has a particular kind of political salience, both positively and negatively, right? Because positively, I think there's a lot of knowledge out there now about how bad those deals are. And it seems kind of patently absurd to any normal person that you're subsidizing a stadium for a billionaire. And yeah, that was a good example of a privately financed one. The Las Vegas Golden Knights hockey arena up in Las Vegas was also 100% privately financed. The state then turned around and spent $750-something million on a stadium for the Raiders. But, you know, they got one right. But I think your positivity in general is right. When I first started writing and reporting about this kind of thing, it was kind of back in 2008. We were coming out of the Great Recession, the financial crisis, going into the Great Recession. And one of the first stories that popped into my radar when I was covering this topic was up in Detroit, where they were literally turning off the streetlights to save money on the city budget while building a hockey arena for a billionaire. And it's like, that seems incorrect. And then you start delving into it, right? And there's so many layers to this. But I think, yes, in general, at that time, I felt like I was kind of on an island and nobody cared about this and there was no organizing being done about it. And it's just the machine was chugging along. And now there is a lot more knowledge. When you do put specific deals in front of voters, they do tend to vote them down while the political capital the politicians themselves build is still very worthwhile and tends to help them get reelected, a straight up referendum vote on these deals at the moment tends to not go through. But that's been sort of paired with the corporations themselves getting very, very, very good at this. Like I said before, sort of an industry unto itself. There are actually these guys called site selection consultants, and this is their job, is to go in and play states, cities, counties off against each other in order to gin this up. And they have very slick models and billboards and, you know, PowerPoint presentations, and this is all going to be great for you. And politicians have a fear of kind of losing out of something. They'll have of seeing the guy across the line be able to take credit for something. But yeah, there has been a trend towards more interest in the topic for sure. Like I said, when I first started writing about this, there was very little. And now all the time, interest from normal folks, like I said, on the Substack, but also from elected officials. Like I know lots of great champions across the country now who want to knock this stuff off and think that it's inappropriate. We work on the specific issue of banning non-disclosure agreements in these deals, which I think is one of the most offensive parts of a lot of these corporate subsidy deals, is that the politicians, public officials, elected office holders themselves sign these non-disclosure agreements with corporations saying that they are bound by contract not to tell you, the public that they work for, what they are doing with your money. And it's totally outrageous. And I think it's super corrupt. And I think any normal person that you explain it to finds it corrupt. And a bill to literally ban that practice actually went through the New York State Senate on a vote of 61-0, which is the first time that there's been a successful vote on such a ban anywhere in the country that I'm aware of. We have a nice bipartisan coalition. It's a really weird bedfellow situation, left, right, libertarians, super socialists, all working together to try and ban this practice. We couldn't get it all the way through in New York. We got it through one house, which I think is a nice first step. But like that sort of thing just happens all over all the time because the corporations have gotten very good at this. And like the secrecy is intentional. I think, you know, that's probably something your folks have experienced all the time. Getting information on this stuff is impossible. Like for every great, you know, Nicole Galloway report, how many of these things sail through that no one's able to find out about because they weren't publicly listed or they were publicly listed at the last possible second, covered with NDAs so no one could talk about it until it was too late. Local businesses, again, who are being forced to subsidize their competitors, can't voice any opposition until it's far too late. And that's all intentional. That's part of the machine. So while I think lots of folks have found out about this and are outraged, rightfully outraged by it, and want to learn what they can do, the corporations have reacted by layering on this secrecy to try and keep all of the deal making out of the public eye.
And it is, I mean, having done some of, when I lived in, right before I left LA in 2016, I was trying to stop a building from going in that was just like this, like, you've got to be kidding me. And it was right behind where I lived, and I lived in a historic building. And we understandably didn't want our neighbors to walk out and be able to touch the parking garage of the building that was being built behind us. Like, literally reach out from their window and touch a wall seemed a little bit egregious. And just the process of going through trying to stop a developer from doing, and it was a Harlan Crow project, if you know anything. I'm sure you know a lot about Harlan Crow.
Yeah,
being,
yeah.
Yeah, he's quite, he was one of the, he didn't give a lot of money towards Donald Trump in 2016, but he gave a lot of money to Ted Cruz. So that tells you what kind of Republican he is. Anyway, so would you try to stop a project like that? Anything that has sort of tax incentives attached to it, or anything that a developer has decided And to me, developers and corporate interests are kind of like two sides of the same coin, are sides of the same coin. They're the same people. They kind of shift hats. They sort of use the same consultants. They use the same business models. Like, they're almost indistinguishable from each other. And it is like playing a game of whack-a-mole, because the minute you, maybe you have like stakeholders in one part of the state or one part of a community trying to fight something egregious when it comes to like a tax break or a tax holiday or whatever, whether it's the example we talked about before with, like, you know, state tax incentives for production, trying to lure, if you're New Mexico and you want Netflix to build a big studio there, one of the ways that you do it is by saying, like, hey, I'll tell you what, like, by the way, we're going to just, like, take, you know, just a cool billion off the top of your head. How does that sound? Or it's that you give away parcels of land to developers for basically, like, no real. So they're very similar. And I wondered if you had a lot of knowledge about the recent, I kind of tagged you on Twitter this morning, I don't know if you had a chance to see it yet, but there was a battle between Oklahoma and Kansas for this Panasonic battery plant.
Oh, yes, I am and, very familiar with this.
Yeah, and so, like, for people that follow our podcast, so because Kansas City is this community that straddles the Missouri-Kansas line, there's often battles between the Kansas City metro is often fighting itself. It's very strange. I don't know that much about that, to be honest, but I know it has happened before. But talk a little bit about this battery plant. And I think, again, like, I think all of this is related to the Galloway audit, because we're basically talking about money that should be public that is going directly back into the hands of private business, right? So talk a little bit about, like, this ridiculous battle for a Panasonic plant and what the possible economic fallout will be for Oklahoma.
Yeah, this is wild. It actually gets at exactly what I was talking about before. I followed the debate over this deal really closely. So Panasonic came in and was proposing to build an electric vehicle battery plant in either Kansas or Oklahoma, forced lawmakers in both states, including the governor of Oklahoma, to sign non-disclosure agreements so that they couldn't publicly confirm not only the identity of what was ultimately Panasonic, but literally where in the state the facility would be. And then bills came before the legislatures in both states. And I sat there and watched the floor debate, which, if any of your listeners have done, you know, is extremely painful to sit there and watch state legislative floor debates.
Especially in Kansas, especially in Missouri, and especially in Oklahoma. Like, those are special kinds of hell. Yeah.
And it was just, it was like you were down the rabbit hole, because everyone kept saying the firm will do this, the firm will do that. And it's sort of like dawns on you after listening to this for 15 minutes, they're all saying the firm because either A, they've signed an NDA and they aren't allowed to identify the corporation they're talking about, or B, they're about to vote on a $1 billion handout and they don't know who it's going to. So they have to say the firm because they literally do not understand the corporation it's going to. So both states passed massive incentive packages without confirming who the ultimate recipient would be. And then Panasonic made this big song and dance last week of finally announcing that it's going to Kansas. But that sort of, to me, is just this perfect distillation of everything that is wrong in this. And it's interesting that you bring up the Kansas-Missouri deal, because the one of the few bright spots actually in this policy world over the last few years is that there is a kind of ceasefire agreement between Kansas and Missouri over the Kansas City metro area, a deal to because, as I'm sure you and all your listeners know, and you can probably go through the gory details much more than I can, the complete absurdity of paying companies to hop back and forth across the state line, just literally like booking jobs in different places. Like, literally nothing new is being created, right? You're just shifting back and forth and back and forth. And in my book, I write about, there was one company that did it three or four times, hopped back and forth across the border, collecting incentives all the way. But now there is this kind of, I think it's tenuous. Like, there's always sort of looks like it's going to come apart, but it's held so far. Ceasefire, at least in that metro area. And actually one of the problems is that yours in Missouri, I believe, is actually legislative. It was actually passed by the state house in Kansas. It's just an executive order. So if they do get a different governor, that could be the way it falls apart. And there's actually precedent for that. Back in the 90s, New Jersey, Connecticut, and New York had a similar non-aggression pact between the three of them to stop using tax incentives to steal companies in that way, but the New Jersey administration changed and the new governor wasn't interested, and so threw the whole thing in the trash and the cycle started all over again. But I think that's an interesting model, and there have been efforts over the last few years to do some version of that, either on a national or a kind of regional level. There have been lots of lawmakers that I work with, and you can go to endtextgiveaways.org to see the list of folks who are interested in this. And if there are some in your state, who are trying to form a binding agreement wherein every state that is in, it's called the Interstate Compact Against Corporate Tax Giveaways, would agree not to use tax incentives to steal jobs from any other state that joined the compact. So it would basically be a ceasefire agreement amongst the states that we're not going to do this to each other. Anyone who isn't in the compact would be fair game, but everyone who's in the compact would not be. There's also an effort to do this. Michigan proposed, there's about 26 Michigan lawmakers proposed just doing it kind of amongst the states that that surround Michigan. I think that's a very promising idea because it gets around the political issue that we talked about, where no one wants to like kind of go it alone on giving up on this stuff because of the real fear that you'll pay a political cost if it looks like everyone around you is doing this stuff and getting getting the benefit
and you
that
can
isn't actually real, but like getting right. the political benefit from it. Whereas this kind of, these kind of agreements, I think, can get around that political problem.
And you can see the headline, right? Like, you know, so-and-so voted no on bringing X amount of jobs to this community. And it, like one really solid example of like just the unrelenting money and impact and effort that undermines the economic stability of regions. And, you know, granted, you know, again, I lived in Los Angeles for a long time. Los Angeles is a fairly economically stable place. There's always an influx of people because the weather's so nice. It's big. The economy is fairly diverse. However, if you worked at the Toyota plant in Carson, California, and got a letter in your inbox one day saying, hey, guess what? We're moving to Texas. There was a PAC headed by none other than Rick Perry. He was governor at the time. How is that possible, by the way? How is that possible that the head of a state could also be the head of a PAC? You tell me. I don't know. The PAC's sole purpose, stated purpose. Do you remember the name of the PAC? It escapes me now.
I don't. I remember this happening. Actually, yeah. The like kick in the pants at the end of this whole story is that after they had relocated to Texas, all of the Toyota executives were like, yeah, the incentives had nothing to do with it. That like it made sense for supply chain reasons and for the regional structure.
But they still got the text.
We'll take your money. Tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. And they're like, sure, we love it. We'll take it. Had nothing to do with our decision.
And if for people that like, so the name of the PAC was something like bring companies to Texas PAC or something. It was so naked. I don't think honestly, like I don't think that's why Tesla moved. I don't think it had anything to do with that. I think Elon Musk is just an asshole and just like likes to pound his chest and go, oh, I don't like mask mandates, but really it was because he just doesn't like paying gains taxes and he wanted to move to Texas where there's no capital gains tax for selling huge amounts of Tesla shares. But anyway, if you're a TV person and you watch a lot of television, I'm trying to think of one TV show. There's a lot of stuff now that's shot on the old Toyota campus because it's still mostly empty because it's a huge swath of real estate. And I don't know what's going on with trying to redevelop it now, but it's like it's in pretty much like a prime location. But if you ever see there's the main Toyota headquarters is really iconic because it's all very circular. So if you see these TV shows now that are shot in this like iconic looking building where it looks like a giant cylinder and you've got all these staircases that kind of swirl up to the top, that is the old Toyota headquarters. I don't know what's going to happen with it. Anyway, so let's talk about one of the things that I always try to do when we're talking about shitty things that happen to voters that didn't ask for all these shitty things to happen to them. What are some of the more kind of common sense things and or like kind of big sort of, I don't know, maybe foundational things that voters could do to ensure that, first of all, there's just straight up transparency so you know who these like entities are that are trying to take money away from either Kansas voters or Oklahoma voters. And also, what are some of the things that we can do on the state, let's just say state level, because local level is such a strange thing here in St. Louis that I, and Kansas City too, because Kansas City has its own issues. But really on a state level, like what are the, aside from keeping Nicole Galloway in office, which is impossible because she's not running.
I know, it's so sad. It's so sad. Come back to us, Nicole.
What's that?
Come back to us, Nicole. Don't leave.
I think she's understandably a little bit exhausted. I don't know if you saw this, but several months ago, I think it was in 2022, it's hard to keep track of all the truly horrifyingly bad, terrible things that Josh Hawley does. But at one point, he tried to stop her office from investigating the attorney general's office's finances while he was the attorney general, because he claimed to be her client and claimed that that would jeopardize his confidentiality, even though she's the state's accountant and she was doing... So he was trying to take away her accountant's license. And so Josh Hawley has used his bully pulpit in part to successfully ensure that Nicole Galloway... I mean, I don't know what one... I don't know her and I don't want to put words in her mouth and I don't want to jump into her head and make her like guess at what caused her to make the decisions that she made, aside from maybe just wanting to spend more time with her family and getting out of what is arguably one of the most toxic environments for any Democrat in the country right now. But I think being bullied by your junior senator about whether or not you can keep your CPA license when that's what you do for a living when you're a relatively young woman, probably up there, probably straight up there. So aside from begging Nicole Galloway to stay in office too late, hoping that we could dial back the clock and elect her as governor also too late, what are some of the other things that you've seen voters be able to execute on a statewide level to at least, let's just say, level the playing field so that public money remains public, like just so that money, public money, stops transferring into private hands in this way?
Totally. There's a few things. I mean, one is caring about offices like auditor, which is like, just as I feel like is not on the radar of a lot of folks, but can be really important. And that's at a state or local level, or local county auditors or financial officers. And when they are elected, as they are in a lot of places, that's a really important one. And there are lots of little tactics that normal folks can use to try and get information about these. You can use public records law. You can use open meetings law. There's this great example. I believe it was last year in Maryland, where a group of just concerned citizens in Frederick County, Maryland, had kind of gotten wind that an Amazon Web Services data center was coming into their community. It was really agriculture heavy community. They were concerned about environmental effects. They were concerned about traffic. They were concerned about all sorts of stuff. And they used open meetings law, and the state open meetings board actually dinged both the county government and a local government for breaking, essentially having illegal meetings with Amazon. And Amazon ended up getting like annoyed enough at the entire process and the fact that the community was trying to have a say that they left and decided not to move forward with the project. So it was just a great example of using the tools at your disposal. Ask, look, when you suspect a deal is happening, ask your local officials if they're bound by an NDA. You'll get really goofy answers, and then you can kind of use that as fodder for any sort of campaign. And then, yeah, caring about who's in your state house, because state houses do have tons of power over this area, both on the financial side, but also just in their ability to bind the activities of local officials. So finding great state house champions, and they are all over the place. There are some great ones across the country. Senator Robert Peters in Illinois, Representative Anna Addiscomani in Florida, Senator Mike Giannaris up in New York, Representative Sarah Namorado in Pennsylvania. These folks who really get it and who want to try and fix this problem, And finding those people and trying to get them into office, which I know is really hard because the money always avalanches against you. But if you can get them in, there's tons of stuff that they can do. And we actually will, in just a few months, I can preview, we'll be having a set of legislative stuff that state houses can do on this topic to try and both just end the practice, but also to bring transparency to it. And so I will make sure you get it and can recommend it to your listeners when it comes out.
Well, I would love for you to come back and talk about it.
Perfect. Let's do that. Let's just book it right now.
Okay, let's just book it right now. Yeah, and especially because in Missouri, one of the challenges that we have, and I think you'll nod vigorously to this, that we have some of the most draconian term limits for state lawmakers in the country. And to say that that affects us negatively is the biggest understatement I can make. And like, it's, yeah, sure, when somebody like Nick Schroer, who you've never heard of probably, who's a true troll of a human being who has no business being anywhere near a restaurant bathroom, let alone like a state legislative body, and he's currently running for state Senate, it's all bad. And there's just dozens more like him. Like, yeah, when somebody like him terms out, you're like, whew. But then there is just a host of other really competent lawmakers who, I mean, okay, fine, maybe if we wouldn't have term limits, they could at least be longer. But the reason they're defined the way they are is because they're just long enough to make it sound reasonable and just short enough to cut people off at the knees when they start to finally understand how the literal sausage gets made. So that's just kind of what I'll end with like you know, looking for the connections between places where this is the most egregious. And oh my God, do they also have really bad term limits for state lawmakers?
Or just no state, like no resources at the state level. The number of folks I talk to who are like, yeah, I have to deal with 1,000 bills by myself because I have no money to hire staff. I share one assistant with 4 other people in the state house.
Like you just, yeah, and
that's just a recipe for lobbyists writing bills. Like that's just what happens.
We're definitely heading in that direction. It's not good. It's not good, Pat. That's why I have you here. And one of the mottos that we use on our podcast is to change the conversation. So I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. You've been great. And I really look forward to you coming back. And please do. Like, you have an open invitation to come back to talk about whatever you want. Because this stuff is super sexy to our listeners. And I mean sexy in the way that it makes them angry, but it also makes them just angry enough to do something. So
I promote one last thing before
you can
I
promote
go?
Whatever you want. Yeah.
On July 28th, we are having an event on this very topic with a bunch of the great champions that I just talked to, including a representative from Oklahoma named Colin Walkie, who's really great and was really outraged by all the NDAs and will complain about them vociferously, I imagine. So on the American Economic Liberties Project website, which is economicliberties.us, you can RSVP to come to this event. It's virtual. Please check it out. It's at 1 p.m. on July 28th. I would love to see as many of your listeners there as possible.
That's amazing. And please invite any reps that you know of who are really involved in this issue to come on the podcast. They have an open invitation, especially if they're in our backyard. Like, I would love to talk to more folks from Oklahoma, because I feel like I look at Oklahoma and I see Missouri, especially because the Tulsa newspaper and the St. Louis newspaper are owned by the same company. Anyway.
Hey.
Well, thank you so much again for coming on.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
The Heartland Pod is a production of Midmap Media, LLC. Follow us on Twitter with @TheHeartlandPod. With email, you can reach us, heartlandpod2020@gmail.com, online with heartlandpod.com. Subscribe, and please sign up for our Patreon with patreon.com/heartlandpod. Become a podhead or an official podgressive today and unlock all of our content. See you at the next show.